This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, building an artificial island. How viable might it be for the small atoll nation of Tuvalu as it looks for ways to deal with the possible impacts of climate change? The government there is looking for backers of an ambitious plan that was first put forward by council elders.
The idea was to get some soil and sand from the bigger lagoon and fill it up. It will reclaim like 5 square kilometres.
More on that coming up soon. Also, Indonesia's president talks up development as a way to deal with the problems facing the West Papua region. We'll have more on that, analysis on that and much more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Growl. But first this morning, it is now less than a month before the people of Bougainville vote in what will be an historic referendum on possible independence from PNG. It has been a long time coming after the island, of course, was racked by a deadly civil war in the 1990s. Now, this all, obviously, the preparations are underway, and it comes as there's been news confirming that two Russian-built attack helicopters that had been bought by the PNG government in the 1990s as part of its controversial plans to bring the island under control. The news is that these helicopters have actually been buried at a rubbish dump in Australia's very north. Now, they were part of the saga that's now known as the Sandline Affair, a multi-million deal the PNG government had signed with a private military company called Sandline International that would have also seen several dozen mercenaries deployed to Bougainville. But the attack helicopters were intercepted by Australia back in 1997. They've been kept at an Australian Air Force base for almost 20 years before finally they were quietly disposed of, as Jarno Gibson reports.
It's an unlikely setting for the final chapter of an international diplomatic crisis, but Darwin's waste dump holds an extraordinary secret beneath the surface.
A few years ago, we had a couple of shipping containers turn up here that were required to be buried.
The shipping containers had arrived from the Royal Australian Air Force Base at Tyndall near Katherine.
We were alerted that they were aircraft in those containers.
Staff at the tip didn't know it at the time, but the Defence Department has now confirmed to the ABC that the aircraft inside those containers were two Russian-made military attack helicopters that controversially ended up at Tyndall more than 2 decades ago as part of what was known as the Sandline Affair, which made international headlines in 1997.
When did the Australian government learn that the Sandline mercenaries had actually arrived in Papua New Guinea?
A private UK military company called Sandline International had been contracted by the Papua New Guinea government to supply dozens of mercenaries and two Russian-made attack helicopters as part of a $36 million deal designed to quash a separatist uprising on Bougainville. But the plan never eventuated. The mercenaries were booted out of PNG, the country's prime minister was forced to resign, and the attack helicopters, which had been on their way to Port Moresby, were diverted mid-flight to Australia, where they languished at the Tyndall Air Base for years amid a dispute over their ownership. It took more than a decade before that dispute was resolved, and in 2011, the Darwin Aviation Museum received a tantalising offer to acquire the choppers.
Absolutely fascinating. I mean, where else in Australia can you get at that time? Could you go and see two notorious Russian attack helicopters up close?
Some of the Russian ones actually had standalone missiles.
The attack helicopters would have been on show alongside other historic equipment, but by that stage they'd deteriorated significantly, and there was another major concern.
A lot of Russian aircraft had asbestos throughout the construct, and that was the case with these, so we just dropped it from there.
From machines of war to industrial waste, this is where the attack helicopters were eventually buried. The Defence Department says any hazardous materials, including asbestos wire insulation and explosives in the door jettison system, were either removed or rendered safe prior to the choppers being disposed of.
As a person who likes aviation, I'd love to dig them out and take them for a fly, but you know, that's not going to happen. Look, it just adds some notoriety to the site, I suppose. I'm sure it's going to become an urban legend over time.
An urban legend linked to a very real conflict.
It's Jano Gibson reporting there. Well, the man who was in charge of PNG's Defence Force at the time, Jerry Singerock, says the burial of the two attack helicopters is a fitting end. Now, as we've heard, that plan to engage the private military company Sandline never eventuated. There was public outrage when it became public, and Commander Singerock took the mercenaries hostage, in fact, and announced the contract had been cancelled. He says the helicopters would have been used to commit genocide if they'd made it to Bougainville. He spoke with Liam Fox.
Well, I'm happy that they've been finally buried because they're the instruments to bring in misery and mass murder genocide by Sandline International and the Papua New Guinea government.
So a fitting end, do you think, to those helicopters?
Absolutely fitting.
What do you think could have happened if they had have made their way to Bougainville?
There'll be a bloody war. It will be like a blood diamond in Angola. Mercenaries are ruthless. It's a machine that has no mercy. They could have caused mayhem.
And so what do you think about the actions of the Australian government to detain those helicopter gunships and other weapons and ammunition as well back in 1997?
Yes, it was a collaboration between myself and late General John Maker, who was the Chief of Australian Defence Force, when I called him and I told him to intercept that Antonov that was bringing in the helicopters and arsenals for Bougainville. And he did, the Australian military did intercept the aircraft. And in collaboration, they detained it, and it was the best act ever to have taken place to prevent the aircraft from landing, delivering the arsenal in Port Moresby.
And I guess it's timely in a way, this news coming out of the burial of these helicopters just ahead of the referendum in Bougainville. As you mentioned before, it could be seen by some as a kind of a closure of a dark period of history.
Yes, that's correct. It is a closure of a dark history of the way manner in which Papua New Guinea government handled a series of Papua New Guinea governments that handled the crisis in Bougainville from 1989 to 1997, and of course the involvement of Rio Tinto and the Australian government. It was a touch and go for the Australian government. They were not really sure what to do. They could not condemn. They didn't know what to say until I kicked out Sandline in 97.
Sir Julius Chan, Prime Minister at the time, wrote a book where one of the things he said was that he regretted nothing and wouldn't have changed a thing. Did you see that? And what did you think about that?
Well, he's totally irresponsible leader. I still maintain that he was singly responsible for bringing in Sandline because he was the chairman of the National Executive Council, and I think he acted criminally as far as I'm concerned.
And I'm guessing you would have similar sentiments of your own actions to his in that you don't regret what you did back then?
No, I did the unorthodox thing, which is to use my powers as a commander to prevent a massive genocide. And I still, to this day, say that I did the right thing because I was acquitted in 2007 of all criminal charges.
That is the man who was the former commander of the PNG Defence Force, Jerry Singerock. He was speaking there with Liam Fox.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, Tuvalu's government's backing a plan to try and create an artificial island as one way of helping them adapt to rising sea levels and the impacts of climate change. Now, it is, of course, an ambitious goal that was first proposed by elders of Tuvalu's largest atoll, try and use silt build up in the lagoon as the base of a new island. But it's not just Tuvalu that's considering building islands to try and tackle sea level rise. 8 artificial islands were recently created in the Maldives, which is another small island nation, while the United Arab Emirates is also home to Palm Jumeirah, which is the world's largest man-made island. And closer to home in the Pacific, Kiribati's former president, Anote Tong, has raised the possibility of that country using artificial islands to also fight the effects of climate change.
To overcome that, you've got to really throw away everything. Don't think in straight linear terms. Take it all apart. And think about doing something crazy like building an island.
Well, it might be considered crazy by some, but in Tuvalu, the country's new Prime Minister, Kasea Natano, is interested in pursuing it. He's in Japan seeking funding from donors to try and support the project, which is reported could cost around $800 million to create just 5 square kilometres of new land. Selingana Kofe is the head chief of Funafuti. He's been lobbying for the project and spoke with our reporter, Evan Wasuka.
There's nowhere else in Tuvalu to go to. To escape from the sea level rise. Going overseas, relocating abroad, there will be a lot of problems. We'll lose our identity as a people. We will lose our language, our culture. We will be merged into another country. The other thing is the loss. We have a 200-mile exclusive economic zone, which is a source of a lot of money for Tuvalu at the moment because of the tuna fishing.
We've seen in the Maldives, they've reclaimed islands there in the Maldives, and in Saudi Arabia, the world's biggest artificial island is there. So the technology is there. What do you think is needed next to make this happen for Tuvalu?
We need the support of the Tuvalu government to start off with. And that seems to be forthcoming now with the Prime Minister, the Prime Minister of Tuvalu, doing the fundraising, if you like, asking Japan and a few other countries. We also thinking of asking Australia and New Zealand and Taiwan and the U.S. Mainland China is also, snooping around there. And, they approach us, but our policy, the government has announced it, the policy is not going to China, mainland China, it's sticking with Taiwan. We are seeking also development financing. We are all praying for a good outcome for this, because this is, I think it's a very worthwhile way. For people, atoll island people whose islands are sinking, the normal way out of this is to be evacuated, to declare yourself as a climate change refugee or environment refugees.
That is Selinga Kofe, the head chief of Funafuti in Tuvalu. We're speaking there with Evan Wasukan. Well, online abuse has become common for people who use the internet, and for women, they can particularly experience anything from trolling to continued harassment that can extend to unwanted calls and text messages. Does it sound familiar? Now, often strangers are behind it, but these platforms are also being frequently used by perpetrators of domestic violence to intimidate their victims. New research here in Australia has found that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women are most at risk. Bridget Fitzgerald has more on the story.
Domestic violence isn't always physical and it isn't always inflicted by a single perpetrator. Gemma Spee runs Gender Service, which works with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women who've experienced violence and sexual assault in Perth.
Often the family will also seek out the victim through social media, harass, bully and threaten them, which puts massive stress and pressure on the victim at an already incredibly difficult time.
She says this kind of online harassment isn't isolated to, but is more commonly experienced by, Indigenous women.
I find that the family definitely want to jump on board to support their other family members. So when there is a confrontation with other people and other families, will come to their defence.
A new research from the eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant, backs this up.
The fear of shaming and even family or mob retribution, social isolation combined with financial difficulty, and then the emotional pressure from extended family meant that some of these women ended up returning to the abusive perpetrator even after extended face-to-face and technology-facilitated abuse.
This kind of abuse can take many forms, from aggressive calls or texts to harassment on social media and even the sharing of videos of physical fights.
Technology-facilitated abuse is just another way to weaponize control, surveillance, stalking, harassment against these women or whoever their target is.
Julie Inman-Grant says many Aboriginal women will seek out elders and family members for support, which is why her next report will focus on giving them the tools to be able to help women being targeted.
So that they're prepared and have the information they need to help any of their friends that are experiencing technology-facilitated abuse.
Macquarie University Professor of Indigenous Studies Bronwyn Carlson has done extensive research into the online abuse hurled at Aboriginal people.
If you think about the lengthy history of violence against Indigenous women, this is a big history of violence towards Indigenous women that goes unaccounted for in this country.
And she's welcomed the pledge from the eSafety Commissioner to develop some specific ways of helping Indigenous people avoid or at least deal with the abuse.
The problem is that there's hardly any resources that are Indigenous specific. And what I find is a lot of Indigenous people won't seek help from agencies that appear to be government agencies because there's a lot of distrust in that space.
It's Bronwyn Carlson ending that report from Bridget Fitzgerald. Well, Indonesia's president has this week visited parts of the country's two Papua provinces with a message that building major infrastructure projects in the troubled region is his priority now that he's been sworn in for another five-year term. But the development-focused policy is one that Joko Widodo's taken previously and some experts argue isn't working with the disenfranchised Melanesian population who've been among those protesting in recent months, some calling for a new vote on independence for the region that's often referred to just as West Papua. It has, in fact, as we've reported here on Pacific Beat, seen some of the worst bloodshed in decades, including more than 30 people being killed in protests last month. The president, though, made little public comments about the unrest during his trip this week. As you can hear, he was welcomed, in fact, by a traditional dance and greeted by local residents in the Arfak Mountains in West Papua Province, where he was promising to build key infrastructure in the remote area. So here he's talking about in the Arfak Mountains what's needed are roads so they can help locals transport things like their agriculture products to the major towns. He also talked about plans or promises to build an airport for the area. Now, close observers have been left disappointed that the president doesn't appear to have addressed the issue of racism that's believed to have set off the recent violence and also the ongoing concerns that there are about alleged human rights abuses. Jaho Pungankas focuses on the Papua region in his work at the Indonesian Institute of Sciences. I spoke with him earlier for his take.
Many West Papuan activists feel disappointed for the visiting of president, because the president only talk about the building of infrastructure project. I see that President Jokowi does not change his policy and strategy from the previous 5 years. I visited many times both in West Papua and in Papua province that they do need only the physical infrastructure. The local government or regional government have already built many schools, many health centers. But the problem is there is not enough of teachers, there is not enough of the teaching and there's not enough paramedics and medicine. So I think the most important is how to build the human resources of West Papuan people. This is the first problem. And the second problem is, even though West Papua are many construction road, many airport, many seaport, but the question is who can benefit or who can pass the street? Yeah, because from the research of my institute, most who benefited from the infrastructure development is the migrant people or the people from outside of West Papua. And the West Papuan only take a little advantage, a little economic advantage from the infrastructure development.
The president had previously indicated that he would be open to holding comprehensive dialogue with Papuans, including those, in fact, who are advocating for independence. This trip, obviously, to the region would have been a good opportunity. Do we know if the president has made that happen? And if not, why not?
I think the Jokowi has an idea to have dialogue, but he is not supported by his ministers in the past. I am not sure in the current minister because no minister around Jokowi talk about the dialogue. The problem is that the government still, they don't have agreement about how to resolve the West Papuan conflict. Development is the only strategy used by the current government to resolve the West Papuan.
This is the Papua expert Jaho Pamungkas. He's from the Indonesian Institute of Sciences. Well, Vanuatu's sports minister wants to see more sporting links between his country and Australia, and he's held recent talks with his counterpart here to try and make it happen. Now, Vanuatu has had similar deals with other countries. For example, in the lead up to hosting the Pacific Mini Games in 2017, Vanuatu sent a sizable cohort of elite athletes to China for expert coaching. But now the minister, Francois Chani, is keen on finding options a little closer to home. He spoke with Richard Hewitt about it being all part of a push for Vanuatu to stage the Pacific Games in Port Vila in 2027. The Council of Ministers is in fact expected to sign off on Vanuatu's bid later today.
Our long relationship with the Pacific family, Australia and New Zealand, I hope they would be supporting us in hosting the bid. The help where we can get from it, I think it's fantastic. I think that's where we look at it first, and I'm sure they would be wanting to help us, you know, if we have to host the game. So, of course, there will be lots of people coming to us and ask for, you know, if they can help us setting up the game or whatever. But I think we would want to have that support. And also phase three of Olympic game for beach volleyball girls. And I want to ask the Australian government to support us for our bid to host that phase three of volleyball to be done in Port Vila before Tokyo in 2020.
That would really make a statement, wouldn't it? Because volleyball has been leading the way for Vanuatu. Volleyball and then the soccer success at the Under-20 World Cup a couple of years ago. Those have been the two flagship sports for Vanuatu in recent times. Plus, of course, your para athletes winning medals at the Commonwealth Games.
The para and then the volleyball, they are champions. So I think, you know, we have to put all our effort to this discipline. For the volleyball girls out there, Vanuatu flag around the world, and it's fantastic for us. So that's why I'm trying to gather support just for us to host that phase three qualifier to go to Tokyo. It's been fantastic for us, and that's going to be another momentum to get us to the 2027 game. So all of this thing is so important for Vanuatu. Anything that we can grab just to keep that momentum, we have to grab it. We have to make sure that our authority is ready, the government is ready to allow the authority to go and seek donors for contribution to help us to grow. As we know, sport is everything. Like a country without sport, what would be the country? Especially in Vanuatu, with everything that happened in Vanuatu, the high level of NCD in Vanuatu, the high level of disease in Vanuatu, we need to start to bring sport back in the forefront of everything in Vanuatu. We have lots of youth now in Vanuatu, and we need them to be occupied. We need the government to start to realize that what are we going to do with these youth? These youth are naturally blessed with talent. We have to start to give them an outing, you know, somewhere where they can go and start to practice their talent to feed up to the elite program. And that's why that momentum that we're talking about, we must not let go. So we have to keep that fire burning.
Prior to the mini games, there was a sizable contingent of sporting talent from Vanuatu who went out to China and got specialist coaching over there. I mean, is that something that you would see being repeated, or would you like to try something similar here in Australia or New Zealand?
Well, you know, we sent him to China, and guess what? When they come back, we back so many medals. So it shows that when you send your athletes somewhere else, with different environment, different training, different nutrition, they're coming back stronger. And what I've been proposing, what I've been saying when I just went into my ministry, I said, look, I want our athlete to continue that. But why not Australia, we're so close to us? And why not New Zealand is so close to us? Instead of sending them all the way to China, and thank you for Chinese government to do that for us. But what about the two countries that they are so good at sport, they love their sport, why can't they take our elite, train them for 2 or 3 months, and then come back? You know, that's one thing that I've mentioned. Maybe the Australian government can do that. There's premises in Australia, there's business in Australia, gyms in Australia that they can house these people. You just have to pay the trainers, you know, instead of sending all the way to China. And the athlete in Vanuatu prefer that, prefer to come and train in Australia and New Zealand rather than go all the way to China. But if it's only China that offers, well, I will jump on it too.
That is Francis Chinese, Vanuatu's Minister for Youth and Sports, speaking there with Richard Hewitt. That's it for Pacific Beat. Have a great day.